one of the walls of the house and knock it down, because they told us that every house in Gaza is booby-trapped. And then when we got inside the house, we took all of the men from 16-year-old until 80-years-old, and we put them on a truck, drove them back to Israel for interrogation. And then when we put our sniping rifles on the rooftop, we saw there's lots of new greenhouses that we didn't saw in the aerial photograph. So we called the D9 bulldozer that smashed everything down, so we will have a clean line of fire. And I think that's the difference between the ongoing occupation with settlements and checkpoints in the West Bank and the occupation by siege that we have in Gaza since 2007 and the level of brutality or firepower that we use over there.
Well, there's clearly a lot to talk about here. We're going to ask you to stay for a few minutes for a post-show. Nadav Weinman is Deputy Director of Breaking the Silence. Tal Sagi is Education Director. They're on a tour on college campuses around the United States and Canada, making their way to the Canadian Parliament. That does it for our show. I want to wish David Prude a happy birthday. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for our digital fellowship. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Now produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Sharif Belkadus, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnock, Trinan Adura, Sam Alcock, Tamari Astudio, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO just finished our annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign, and we'd like to thank all of our supporters for helping us bring engaging, unique, and all-around fun special shows and killer marathons to the community. We wouldn't be able to do it without our listeners, and if you missed out on any of our programming, you can check out the list of specials at kboo.fm/thrills.
Support for this program comes from KBOO members in the Portland Housing Bureau, announcing the opening of the North Northeast Preference Policy Home Ownership Waitlist, helping longtime and displaced residents to purchase a home in their community. The application deadline is April 19th. Information for the Preference Policy Home Ownership Waitlist at portland.gov/PHB.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the EPA will strictly limit PFAS in drinking water for the first time ever.
A new Boeing whistleblower raises the alarm about the safety of the 787 Dreamliner.
And in local news, food cart owners near PSU rally together to save their pod from closing.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 10th, 2024. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Marty Wall. The Environmental Protection Agency puts the first ever limits on forever chemicals in drinking water. The EPA mandated that water providers reduce per- and polyfluorinated substances, known collectively as PFAS, to near zero levels. The compounds are best known as forever chemicals because they never fully degrade, so they can accumulate in the body and in the environment. These chemicals are used in a wide variety of products and can be found in the blood of almost every person in the United States. A 2023 government study of private wells and public water systems detected PFAS in nearly half the tap water in the country. Michael S. Regan, the EPA administrator, said, quote, "This action will prevent thousands of deaths and reduce tens of thousands of serious illnesses." The EPA estimated it would cost water utilities about $1.5 billion annually to comply with the rule, though utilities maintain that the cost would be twice that amount. Public water systems have 3 years to complete their monitoring of PFAS. If those samples show that levels exceed the new EPA standards, the utilities would have another 2 years to purchase and install equipment designed to filter out PFAS.
A new Boeing whistleblower has come forward with allegations about the 787, and the Federal Aviation Administration says they'll investigate. Sam Salapour is a longtime Boeing engineer. He claims that he saw serious problems with how the plane's fuselage is put together, and that production shortcuts could mean these planes don't last very long, even potentially falling apart mid-flight. Salapour said at a press conference Tuesday, quote, it can cause a catastrophic failure. He points to gaps in the panels that, in 2021, caused the FAA to prevent the company from shipping out those planes. Salapour says instead of fixing the problem with those gaps, Boeing just used more force to fit them together. He said, quote, Boeing hid the problem by pushing the pieces together with force to make it appear like that gap didn't exist. I literally saw people jumping on the pieces of the airplane to get them to align. That's not how you build a plane, end quote. Boeing, for their part, denies these claims and says they're fully confident in the 787 Dreamliner. Salapour is the second Boeing whistleblower to raise concerns about the 787. The other, John Barnett, was found dead by gunshot wound in his truck in California in March, in the midst of his testimony in a lawsuit against the company.
The allegations come at a rough time for Boeing. The company has been in crisis since January when the door plug panel blew off the 737 MAX jet in midair over Portland. Last week, Boeing agreed to pay Alaska Airlines $160 million in initial compensation for the incident. That payment is to cover the financial losses Alaska Airlines suffered as a result of the incident, including lost revenue and having to ground a subset of its planes, the MAX 9s. After Alaska grounded their fleet, the FAA grounded all MAX 9 planes in the U.S. The FAA and the National Transportation Safety Board are investigating the January incident, including whether it violated a 2021 settlement that reached with Boeing for misleading the regulators. Boeing may also settle with another impacted companies, like United, whose planes were impacted by the grounding. The newest whistleblower, Salapour, is expected to testify before the Senate committee next week, and the FAA is investigating his claims.
Access to Washington State's long-term care program will increase because of action during this year's legislative session. But the program also faces a challenge on this year's ballot. Starting in 2026, Washingtonians will have access to up to $36,500 in benefits from the WAH CARES Fund. A bill passed during this year's legislative session allows access to the program even if the contributor moves out of state. Home care aide Julie Sparkman says this was an important development for her adult children.
The portability of WAH CARES is really important because you never know where you're going to go. The older you get, sometimes life takes you other places. And people should be free to do that. They shouldn't be stuck in a situation where it was the only way to access the benefits that they paid into.
Workers started automatically contributing a little more than 0.5% of their paychecks into the fund in July 2023. Initiative 2124 on the November ballot would allow workers to opt out of the program. Opponents of WAH CARES say some of the people who pay the tax will never use the program's benefits. However, if too many workers opt out, it could crater the finances for the program. Advocates, including Sparkman, worry that if the initiative passes, it would effectively repeal WAH CARES.
I'm really proud every time I see that on my paycheck stub. I'm happy with that because that is my participation in what I think socially needs to happen. And even if I never use it, I'm extremely happy to be a part of it.
In the past few years, Sparkman was diagnosed with breast cancer and had it treated. She says WAH CARES might be important for her in the coming years.
Sometimes cancer comes back. So if I have a problem going forward, maybe the instability that that causes won't be as bad because WAH CARES exists.
That was home care aide Julie Sparkman.
Four food carts located across from the Portland State University Library may be forced to close this summer due to a sewage system dispute. Recently, an inspector from Portland's Bureau of Environmental Services documented improper disposal of the food cart pods, grease, and debris. The Bureau issued a compliance order to PSU, either connect the sewer system or close the food carts entirely. As a result, PSU officially cut ties with the Asian and Mediterranean restaurants via email back in February. The food cart pod isn't currently connected to the regular sewer system. Instead, food cart owners have to use gray water tanks that require maintenance up to 3 times a week. Jeff Martin is the interim environmental health director with Multnomah County. He says these wastewater tanks are only starting to be phased out as of this year. Fasil Obadi is the owner of Mediterranean food cart Shish Shawarma. He is also studying business at PSU. Obadi expressed concerns about the potential shutdown. He said, quote, I'm trying to thrive my business. Slowly, I feel like they are trying to take that away from me, end quote. The food cart owners are expected to cover the sewer connection costs themselves, which exceeds $40,000 in total. This left them with no choice but to ask the community for help. Obadiah started a GoFundMe page to raise enough money for all food carts to connect to the city's sewer system.
The Arizona State Supreme Court gave ominous meaning to turning back the clock, reinstating an 1864 law that bans almost all abortions. Roe v. Wade had prevented the state from enforcing the old law, but the U.S. Supreme Court overruled Roe in 2022. The law outlaws all abortion from the moment of conception, with exceptions only in the case of a pregnant woman facing life-threatening health impacts, no exception for rape or incest. Doctors who provide abortion care could face fines and 2 to 5 years in prison. Arizona State Attorney General Chris Mays said, quote, today's decision to reimpose a law from a time when Arizona wasn't a state, the Civil War was raging, and women couldn't even vote will go down in history as a stain on our state, end quote. However, the solution to the past could be in the near future. Last week, organizers with Arizona for Abortion Access announced that they had collected more than enough signatures needed to put a referendum on a constitutional amendment enshrining the right to abortion care on state ballots in November.
Arizona upholds a near-total, civil-era abortion ban. Hundreds inside the Capitol pray for Gaza ceasefire. An RFK Jr. aide says she wants to take blue northeastern states from Biden. With more on the story, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
And the near total Civil War era ban that continues to hang over our heads only serves to create more chaos for women and doctors in our state.
Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs spoke for many when she objected to the state Supreme Court upholding a near total 160-year-old abortion ban. One of the strictest in the country, the ban lacks exceptions for rape, incest, or pregnancy complications, allowing an abortion only if the pregnant person's life is endangered. Hundreds of Christians closed the U.S. Capitol cafeteria to pray for a permanent Gaza ceasefire, an end to Israeli arms sales, support for the UN's aid agency there, and the release of hostages. Reverend Naomi Washington Liebhart with Christians for a Free Palestine decries the right-wing Christian support for Israel's attacks.
I've gone to Palestine and seen with my own eyes the atrocities of violence against the Palestinian people. And I won't stand by while Christian texts are used to baptize militarism, underwrite famine, and mask anti-Semitic and Islamophobic theologies.
Rita Palma, an anti-vaccine activist and New York State director for Robert Kennedy Jr., says they aim to rally Republicans behind Kennedy to challenge President Joe Biden. Palma says she voted for former President Donald Trump twice and says Kennedy could deny Biden some northeastern blue states.
If the Republicans accepted the fact that New York, Maryland, Illinois, California, New Jersey, Connecticut, most of the Northeast is going to go blue, why wouldn't we put our vote to Bobby and at least get rid of Biden?
A wide and bipartisan range of groups, including historians, former lawmakers, and even retired military officers, have filed friend of the court briefs against Trump's bid for unlimited presidential immunity. The Supreme Court has scheduled oral arguments later this month. Brian Dorsey was put to death last night in Missouri's first execution this year. Dorsey was convicted of a double murder 20 years ago, but his lawyers argue that he was in a drug-induced psychotic state and was poorly represented. Jenny Gerhauser, a cousin to both Dorsey and his victim, says he had become a better person and should have been spared.
Brian is more than the worst moment of his life. There is so much more to him.
Alabama advocacy groups are suing over Senate Bill 1, a new law limiting help with absentee ballots. Supporters say it reduces ballot harvesting and pressuring voters. But Allison Mulman from the ACLU says the draconian law would stifle democracy by blocking community groups, churches, and neighbors from helping people vote, especially the elderly and those with disabilities.
From how this bill is written is that it is going to put people in harm's way of being incarcerated for decades if they're just doing basic work and trying to make sure that people can exercise their right to vote.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Street Roots digital producer Kanani Cortez about this week's edition of the paper, The Spring Anthology, Volume 1. At 6, it's Sea Change Radio. At 6:30, it's Wings. Then at 7, Eco Justice Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 39. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 61. Today in history, in 1930, American labor leader and civil rights activist Dolores Huerta was born. She's the co-founder of the United Farm Workers, along with Cesar Chavez. She's known for her advocacy for workers, immigrants, and women's rights. Huerta also originated the phrase, si se puede. The quote of the day is from Dolores Huerta, who said, quote, "Every moment is an organizing opportunity, every person a potential activist, every minute a chance to change the world."
A plan for building a tribal substance use recovery center in Wisconsin is facing a NIMBY roadblock, neighbors who don't want it in their area. With that story and more is Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. An intertribal council from Native nations, mostly in Wisconsin, wants to create a substance use recovery center for young people in an area that's considered a treatment desert for recovery facilities. As WXPR's Hannah Davis Reed reports, they've hit a roadblock.
The Great Lakes Intertribal Council, or GLITSI, is a nonprofit organization that serves Native people in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. Over the past 20 years, they've worked on plans for a recovery and wellness center for young people. The 36-bed facility is designed to treat and support Indigenous youth with culturally relevant services and amenities. It would also serve non-Native youth. However, the local town board of Cashin doesn't want the center in their area and has been fighting against it for the last year. Last week, the Oneida County Planning and Zoning Committee denied the permits to build the center. The committee cited a concern of a drop in nearby property values and that GLITSI could place the property in a sovereign trust as its reasoning for rejecting the permit. This is President Shannon Holsey of the Stockbridge Munsee Band of Mohicans, one of GLITSI's member tribes.
You have to remember, sovereign immunity is of the sovereign. You're talking about 12 tribal nations that are involved in this project. So there would not even be continuity to the involvement of whose sovereign immunity it was.
GLITSI does plan to continue with the project, saying it's too important to not reassess and move forward on. I'm Hannah Davis Reed reporting.
This time of year is typically maple syrup season in northern Michigan, when daytime highs get above freezing while nights stay cold. But this year's mild winter meant that people began tapping their trees unusually early in January and February. The Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians took the warmer weather as a sign to let their sugar maples rest. Interlochen Public Radio environmental reporter Ellie Katz has more.
Tara John is gathering kindling for a fire outside the Grand Traverse Band Sugar Shack in Peshawby Town. Off in the distance, we can barely hear the sound of a woodpecker.
That woodpecker is saying that those bugs are underneath the bark are starting to wake up.
John is a tribal member and works with the band's agriculture department on restoring traditional foodways and food sovereignty. She says the sound of woodpeckers are just one of many ecological signs that the trees are waking up again, that it's time to gather for sugarbush.
We are coming back to this forest, to this grove, to these maples. We call them Mininatig, and that's us, our standing brother, our elder brother.
Tapping trees for maple sap, syrup, and sugar is an old Anishinaabe tradition, one that John and the tribe are working to strengthen after generations of settlement made it harder to practice and pass down.
The beginning of the year is sugarbush. When we report for sugarbush, that's like we check in with our family, get the good gossip, we laugh together, you know, argue, yell at nieces, nephews, you know, everything that families do.
The signs to return and tap the trees came too early to Peshawby Town this year, or didn't come at all. Woodpeckers and baby skunks started appearing in January, and the snow didn't come all the way up to the trunks of the trees.
I asked my elders about what to do and what to say, and asked the trees, because they have not been respected or appropriately thanked or allowed to rest for quite a long time.
With that input, she decided the Grand Traverse Band's agriculture department would let the trees rest and then hopefully tap next year. And they're not alone in that choice. Several other tribes, like the Sault Ste. Marie tribe and the Saginaw Chippewa, are doing the same.
That was Ellie Katz, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
New research out of Montana suggests that letting smaller wildfires burn can help head off the damage and danger of larger ones later on. In a new study published in the journal Nature Communications, researchers say the current policy of extinguishing every fire as soon as possible, no matter how small, is leading to what's known as suppression bias. Mark Moran has the details.
A new study in the journal Nature Communications by Montana researchers says suppressing small wildfires is leading to larger, more intense, and damaging blazes. The U.S. Forest Service says about 98% of wildfires are fully suppressed before they grow to 100 acres, most of them within 72 hours. In Montana, the latest data show crews kept 95% of wildfires to no more than 10 acres in 2022. University of Montana researcher and co-author of the new report, Mark Kreider, says this strategy leads to what's known as fire suppression bias.
Removing more of one type of fire than the other, what we're left with is bias towards these higher intensity fires, these more extreme fires.
Montana state policy calls for crews to extinguish fires as quickly as possible, even small ones. Kreider says researchers recommend letting low-intensity fires burn where possible to reduce the risk and damage for potential larger, hotter burning and more catastrophic blazes. Kreider acknowledges as the population grows along the urban-wildland interface, letting fires burn is not always possible, but argues it might be the best strategy for heading off catastrophic fires later.
Especially in the western U.S., where people live in, you know, close to forests, fire suppression is very important, and we still must do it. But this research helps to show when possible and in places when it's safe to do so, we really may benefit from allowing more low and moderate intensity fire to burn.
The National Interagency Fire Center says the number of acres scorched by wildfire has doubled since the 1980s, and the cost to battle the fires has risen to nearly $3 billion a year. I'm Mark Moran for Big Sky Connection.
A nonpartisan group awaits a vote today in the Tennessee House of Representatives on House Bill 04-74, which seeks to ban the study of reparations in the state. The group has gathered over 1,000 signatures so far on a petition to lawmakers to withdraw the bill. Danielle Smith has more in Nashville.
The Tennessee House of Representatives plan to vote today on House Bill 0474 to end the study of reparations in the state. A Memphis nonpartisan group has launched an online petition against the bill with over 1,000 signatures so far urging lawmakers to withdraw it. Pastor Dr. Earl J. Fisher of Up the Vote 901 says his group and others were notified the original vote date was April 4th, marking 56 years since Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination in Memphis. Fisher notes the petition allows public opposition to anti-reparations policies.
We started having conversations about how to not just address this in Congress, but how to address it in court. Because we think if and when the bill passes, it is going to be in violation of people's civil and human rights.
The bill is sponsored by Representative John Regan of Anderson County, and a Senate version is sponsored by Senator Brett Taylor of Shelby County, both Republicans. An amendment to the Senate bill passed last spring prohibits local governments from considering reparations for slavery and any ongoing effects. Fisher says discussions have been underway in Shelby County about using reparations funds to address how to close the racial and economic wealth gaps there. However, he says the resurgence of the House bill threatens to block the disbursement of any such funds for reparations.
What most people don't know is like it's right at the time where they're starting to discuss how $5 million of federal funding actually came through the ARPA fund and was allocated to address some of the racial and economic disparities connected to health disparities in Memphis and Shelby County.
Fisher points out that Shelby County received over $180 million from the American Rescue Plan Act, suggesting $5 million could be allocated to initiatives similar to reparations work. However, the bill would also prevent universities from conducting studies or developing curriculum on these issues, which would hinder progress in these areas. I'm Danielle Smith, Tennessee News Service.
Toxic stress can trigger numerous chronic health conditions, but as Nadia Ramlagan reports, one Ohio psychiatrist is working to raise awareness about toxic stress and how lifestyle medicine changes can help.
The alarming rise in rates of diabetes, obesity, depression, and other chronic health issues has put the spotlight on toxic stress. University of Cincinnati psychiatry and family medicine professor Lawson Wilson explains that good stress, a demand or challenge you readily cope with, is good for your health. Toxic stress, on the other hand, wears down your stress response system in ways that have lasting effects. He says science has shown the chances of developing serious mental and physical illnesses in midlife rise dramatically when people are exposed to trauma or adverse events, especially during childhood.
Every person's threshold for toxic stress depends on the specific characteristics of their stress response system and the cumulative demands that they face over a lifetime.
The earliest effects of toxic stress are often persistent symptoms such as headache, fatigue, or abdominal pain. After months of initial symptoms, a full-blown illness such as migraine headaches, asthma, or diabetes may surface. Research shows it's possible to retrain a dysregulated stress response system. This approach, called lifestyle medicine, focuses on improving health through changing high-risk behaviors and adopting new daily habits. Wilson says positive lifestyle changes can help the stress response system self-regulate.
These approaches combine the daily practice of health behavior changes over 6 to 9 months with the help of weekly small groups of other people working on the same goals. It's not quick, it's not easy, but it works.
The National Diabetes Prevention Program, the Ornish Undo Heart Disease Program, and the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs PTSD Program have been shown to slow or reverse stress-related chronic conditions through weekly support groups and guided daily practice over 6 to 9 months. Wilson says these programs help teach people how to practice personal regimens of stress management, diet, and exercise in ways that build and sustain their new habits. This story was produced with original reporting from Lawson Wilson for The Conversation in association with Media in the Public Interest. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Ohio News Connection.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael thinks economics only exists to make excuses for greed.
On the rare occasion, supply and demand does work to lower prices, as in Donnie's tech stock losing half its value in just a couple weeks. But demand tends to always raise prices, like the motels along the Eclipse's path, or the cost of an Uber late on a Friday or Saturday night. Doesn't matter what the thing or service is worth, but how much can the provider make off it? When beef and chicken prices are each controlled by 3 or 4 companies worldwide or locally, where else are you going to get electricity? We can demand peace all we want, but arms makers keep increasing the supply of fear and thence their profits. There's a high demand for honesty and transparency in politicians and public policy, but the supply is kept to a trickle by those buying favors and opaqueness. And since we feel a high demand to keep living, the insurance and medical industries can keep raking it in while kicking and screaming before giving anything back. I know there's little demand and even less money for poetry, but I'm keeping up the supply. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 10th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, musings, curiosities, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Birdie. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is the incomparable Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Farah Siddiqui, Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Ramlagan, Danielle Smith, and Mark Moran. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Marty Wall. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for our KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Street Roots digital producer Kanani Cortez about this week's issue of the paper, The Spring Anthology, Volume 1. Welcome to the show, Kanani.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with me. So, we're looking at the Spring Anthology issue, Volume 1 today. For folks who don't know, what's that all about?
Yeah, so the Spring Anthology issues are two issues that we publish every spring. I believe now this is the third year in a row. And what it is a kind of overview of the last 12 months of reporting. And so we take a look back and we republish some of what we consider, you know, our best works or most impactful or just things that we think that readers will find worth revisiting. Or if you're a new reader that maybe you missed it the first time around,